Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
And I am here with no stranger to this show, Mr. Joshua Cutchin. Hello, Josh.
Hello, Soraya. Long time no speak.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Man. So we actually recorded this interview already. And the recording software did something I can't even explain. So we're re-recording this interview. Hopefully it'll be better the second time around, but I am going to include a clip here in a moment of exactly what it was doing, because it's the weirdest thing I've ever heard, right here. Important revelations in this book.
I appreciate it. You know, this is sort of my MO.
Yeah, so apparently it decided to play music while we were talking.
Yeah, I have never heard anything like that in my life. That's really unique.
I had one interview in the past, and actually I haven't even posted it yet. I keep meaning to post it, and I keep delaying to do that, where I had a popping noise through the whole interview. That wasn't so weird, and I was able to filter that out so you can't even tell it was there, and everything was there. But this is actually everything we said is there. It's just that it every once in a while stopped and for a split second put a tone in.
Yeah, and what's striking to me is that it's not the same sound every time. Like, it's always constantly changing pitch, and that's a weird one. That's a new one for me.
Yeah, it's all right. It's us. What do you want?
Probably.
Anyway, finally, your new book, The Brimstone Deceit, is out, and it's subtitled An In-Depth Examination of Supernatural Scents, Otherworldly Odors, and Monstrous Miasmas.
Yeah, I was really happy to get that subtitle in there, because what it does is it really sort of lays out the three main sections of the book, which are, you know, supernatural scents, so the sense of the smells of the spirit world, otherworldly odors, smells from UFOs and alien abduction, and monstrous miasmas, which goes into, obviously, Bigfoot or Sasquatch. But this was fun because not only did I get to write about those things, but One of the later chapters in the book goes into all sorts of stuff, like lake monsters and dog man and black-eyed children and black-eyed kids, rather, and men in black and fairies. So a lot of stuff that I don't usually get to write about I was able to include because there are plenty of cases where those things smell, too, in the paranormal literature.
And this is done very differently from your first book, which was on taste, essentially, the food of the paranormal. And, I mean, although it seems like they'd be similar, and they are, I guess, in certain ways, this takes a very different tact with it. I believe you told me that you feel it's more scientific than, say, folklore-ish, like the first one.
Yeah, I think the central piece of information that informs a Trojan feast is really just the folkloric aspect, the folkloric angle. But for this, one of the centerpieces that really ties it together is the science of olfaction, the science of smell. And it's something that it's sort of it's the stitching that holds the whole book together, I think.
And I didn't realize how little we know about smell. I mean, we understand to some degree how sight works. We understand to some degree how taste and hearing work, but the science of smell is really still a bit of a mystery, and there's some really weird stuff going on with it.
Yeah, it's up in the air. We don't really have a great grasp on exactly how it works. The prevailing theory is that there's some sort of key lock configuration in our noses where each cell corresponds to a specific molecule, and if a key, you know, the molecule, and the lock, the actual scent cell, are compatible, there's a certain stimulation that's related to the olfactory bulb and ends up, you know, having electrical impulses fired at the amygdala, which is sort of the ground zero for memory and emotions and decision making. But other people have posited that there's some sort of quantum level at which smell functions, which is definitely not something you would expect. You know, you think that we have these sort of things figured out, but no, smell is actually kind of mysterious. And in a lot of ways, smell is a great metaphor for the paranormal, because not only do we not know how it works, but, you know, a lot of times you'll smell something, but you can't see it. It's invisible, but you know that it's there. You're able to detect it. So it's a lot like the paranormal in a way. You know, the smells are invisible, but they influence our lives. And I think that you could make a similar argument for supernatural forces.
True. It's almost weird how scent has even come about. I mean, because you talk about the how negative smells affect us more than positive smells, and their effect on memory as well.
Right. It's very much tied into memory. For example, there's some research that's coming out nowadays that suggests that an impairment of smell is one of the early signs of Alzheimer's disease. And so some speculation is that this is because smell is tied into our involuntary memory. I mean, anyone who has smelled the perfume of, you know, a previous lover or the cologne of a previous lover knows that if they smell that again, they immediately have memories that just come up unbidden right into their mind's eye. It's we can't control it. It's involuntary and it's instantaneous, which I think, you know, raises some interesting questions in the paranormal perspective, because it seems like it would be a sense that would be very much ripe for deception.
True. Or control.
Right. Yeah. It could be implemented to some end, I think, is a really good way to put it.
I mean, I'm assuming that's part of where the title comes from, the Brimstone Deceit.
It does. You know, it's kind of funny. I was talking with Greg Bishop about this, and it kind of sounds like it might be like an evangelical Christian book, like or Dan Brown's the Brimstone Deceit or something.
Right.
Yeah, but it's not really about that. It's more about like the manner in which sulfur is one of the most common smells in all supernatural phenomena. Common in the sense not that it necessarily represents the majority of smells, but I would definitely say that it represents a plurality of smells. So if it's not 51 or more percent of paranormal encounters that involve the smell of brimstone, it's still probably the largest chunk of single smells are sulfurous smells.
And talk a little bit about the history of sulfur and the idea of sulfur, because it's not – some people think something smells sulfuric and it might actually not be sulfur per se.
Right. So pure sulfur actually doesn't have a smell. It will smell when it is burnt, and it generates a compound known as sulfur dioxide. But a lot of times when people say that they're smelling sulfur, they're actually smelling one of several sulfur compounds. The two most common, especially in paranormal cases, are sulfur dioxide, which is the smell of fireworks or burnt matches, and hydrogen sulfide, which we all recognize as the rotten egg odor. Hydrogen sulfide is one of the primary malodorous components in intestinal gas. And it occurs whenever you have anaerobic decomposition. So decomposition in the absence of oxygen. That's why we have that characteristic rotten egg odor. But it's interesting because sulfur itself was long used as a fumigant and as an antimicrobial agent all the way back into classical Greece, which is why it's interesting when you take a look at sort of the Judeo-Christian tradition. A lot of early Hebrew texts would refer to God's cleansing breath as being like sulfur. And so put in this perspective, we gain some additional insight onto why demonic forces and Satan are often said to smell like brimstone. Not because the devil loves the fact that he got thrown into a lake of fire and brimstone, but that fire and brimstone actually represents more of the divine's attempt to cleanse the devil of evil. So it's not necessarily that they're just evil and they happen to smell stinky. It's actually part of that continuum of part of that longstanding tradition of using sulfur to cleanse.
Hmm. Now, you also, if I'm not mistaken, you said something about sulfur often gets mistaken with ozone, doesn't it?
Yeah, so there's you'll find a lot of conflation between sulfur and ozone. in antiquity, they used to basically use the terms interchangeably. They would say that lightning would race to the ground and leave behind a smell of sulfur in its wake. That's not correct. That smell is ozone. But this is a series of confusing interpretations that continued until relatively recently. I mean, even Ben Franklin was saying similar things. So in a historical context, this has brought up a lot of questions about whether or not UFO witnesses in particular are noticing sulfur or ozone. There have been some researchers in the past who claim that witnesses are always mistaking ozone for sulfur, but I have a couple of problems with that. Number one, I found a lot of very specific sightings where people claim to notice a firework smell or a rotten egg smell. So that runs directly contradictory to that. But number two, if you're going to call into question what the witness smelled and whether or not they recognized it, we might as well start questioning everything about their testimony. So I really don't buy the idea that people, especially in UFO encounters, are smelling ozone and thinking that it's sulfur. I just don't really buy that. Again, like I said, I have plenty of cases where people explicitly refer to a sulfur or a rotten egg smell, which is not at all the way anyone would qualify ozone.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I actually kind of like the smell of ozone.
Well, you know, ozone is often used to disinfect like water sources and whatnot, which is why I think it's interesting that ozone sometimes appears after exorcisms. It's almost like the act of cleansing the evil from the possessed individual leaves behind this sort of ozone scent. You'll find that in post-exorcism scenarios. You'll also find it in seances. Apparently, ectoplasm, whenever it manifests, has been reported to have a smell of ozone attached to it.
How did you find all these accounts? You obviously, I mean, you have, I think we said over 600 footnotes, notes. And I know, I'm pretty sure you haven't read the number of books that you reference in this book.
No, it's actually like 660 sources, but like about 1,000 end notes in the book. Yeah, the last 100 pages are all bibliography and end notes and index. I own about between 80 and 114 books myself, so obviously I went through those. But I also had some other resources. Albert Rosales has recently taken down off the internet his humanoid sighting reports, but those at one point were available until relatively recently in PDF format. Thousands, like tens of thousands of reports of different entities. And it was extremely helpful to have those in that format because it allowed me to come up with search terms, probably about 15 different search terms that I used to sort of try to make that streamline that process a little bit. And from there you could see where, you know, he said that the source was for this particular encounter and you could go track it down. For someone like me, I like to pinpoint individual pages. I like to see it for myself. So
right.
I had to sort of track some stuff down. Google Books was helpful in that regard. I'm fortunate enough to be within very close driving distance, relatively speaking, of my alma mater, so that I was able to utilize their interlibrary loan. So that was all quite helpful. And I was also able to find some digitized versions of old MUFON journal and old Flying Saucer review editions. So basically going through those, again, with a fine-tooth comb and trying to pick out every case that involves a smell or, you know, a whiff or a scent. You know, all these search terms I had to come up with. So that was where the lion's share of the process started. And, you know, I would talk about the sort of thing, and people would send me leads as well. That's finally starting to happen in my career. So yeah, it's a lot of different methods to get to the core cases in this book.
And why did he take all his humanoid reports offline? Do you know?
He started publishing them. He's partnered with somebody and they're sort of taking out the jewels of his humanoid reports and putting them into a book, which is great. And I'm kudos to him for that. The reason that I limit that is because his citing database was like everything that was ever written. Like, it was obscure cases. It was, you know, the big high profile cases. Like, you could find pretty much everything in those that compilation of reports. So, good for him, bad for us, I guess.
And how long did it take you to put all this together?
You know, if I reflect on it, I had started writing this, or I started, you know, doing the research and everything in around August of 2015. And I had a first draft completed, by April. So, and then I just, you know, different, revisions and sort of sitting on it and trying to get it through the publication process, brought us up to, you know, just this past, just about 2 weeks ago.
Wow. You did that fairly quick, actually, for the amount of data, the denseness of the data in this book.
Well, I tried to have everything planned out nice and clearly, so that once I started writing, I could just dive right in. But yeah, I guess you're right. Like, looking back on it, this is a lot of information.
All right. So, what did you find were the most common smells besides sulfur?
So you find this, I'll go ahead and answer the sulfur part too, if that's all right.
Sure.
So within sulfur, it's generally people saying sulfur. It seems like the most common compound that people would report would be hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell, and sulfur dioxide, which is the fireworks smell, like the gunpowder smell. But beyond that, some common ones that you notice, I mentioned ozone, but that's almost exclusive to alien abduction lore. Ammonia was one that cropped up, especially between Bigfoot and UFOs. In spirit sightings or spirit ghost encounters, people often smelled smoke, tobacco smoke, or some sort of perfume. Almost always associated with men and women, respectively. And in Bigfoot, you find a lot of cases of smells of wet dog. Decay is actually common to all three different groups: spirits, UFOs, and Bigfoot. And then you'll have some little outliers here and there. I mean, one of my favorite, extremely evocative descriptions in the book, just because it's so disgusting, is a guy from Idaho who claimed to have seen a Bigfoot, and he said that the smell reminded him of when he was a young boy and he would find a lamb that had given birth to a dead lamb fetus, and that was the same smell this Bigfoot smelled like, which is like the most simultaneously fascinating and disgusting and evocative description I've ever read.
Yeah. That's I don't know that anyone would really know what that smells like.
No, but I can imagine it. I don't like it at all.
Bad. We'll go with bad.
Yeah, I think probably not what you want to smell right before dinner, that's for sure.
Now with the spirit smells, you noted something kind of interesting with the scent of smoke and such, and male and female ghosts.
Yeah, so a lot of my interests nowadays are into the role that the witness plays in these particular encounters. As my good friend Greg Bishop is fond of saying, like, what do we bring to the dance? You know, how much of what we see or what we witness in one way or another is our preconceived notions and our assumptions and you know, what we have kicking around in our own noggins, as it were. I find it really interesting that every time someone smells tobacco smoke in a ghost encounter, they assume it's a man. And every time they smell perfume, they assume it's a woman. Even though women smoked just as much as men in years past, and men have been using cologne since antiquity. So it's really interesting to me that almost without exception, there are a couple cases that I found to the contrary, but almost without exception, these assumptions are made. And I think it really says a lot about the way that we interpret paranormal experiences and paranormal interactions.
It makes you wonder if the ghost is formed around those expectations and even stays that way over time.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of how this, you know, of how we could be interacting with that. Something else that I find interesting is, so these phenomena, spirits, UFOs, Bigfoot, seem to be in control of the situation. They don't get caught on videotape. They don't get caught with their proverbial pants down, as it were. So we have to assume to a certain degree, especially with the UFO phenomena, that everything is chosen for a deliberate reason. That's part of the controlled scenario as well. So if we have certain expectations like that, it seems to me that we could be very easily manipulated by the specific selection of certain scents in any of these categories. Not saying that they each have their own the same level of autonomy. You know, I don't think that Sasquatch can choose scents probably as well as something like the UFO phenomena. But it seems like it would be very easy to manipulate the way that paranormal phenomena present themselves to us by capitalizing on how sensitive we are to smell and how we make certain assumptions.
The spirits, you got a selection of smells, both positive and negative.
Right. The number of pleasant smelling Sasquatch encounters is practically zero.
Yeah.
The number of pleasant smelling alien encounters are a little bit more common. You'll run into people of the contactee variety who, like Orfeo Angelucci, who reported entities that smelled like flowers, not at all dissimilar to the way that the Blessed Virgin Mary apparitions are described. But ghost encounters much more often include these pleasant smells, often of a floral variety, often a perfume or something, especially in the case of the BVM apparitions. Almost every single Blessed Virgin Mary apparition has some sort of floral odor associated with it. And beyond that, you run into a lot of tales of people smelling certain types of perfumes, lilac, lavender. Jasmine is a really common smell that's reported in ghost encounters as well.
And Bigfoot, of course, is just very smelly.
Bigfoot is stinky, apparently. So you'll again, these Bigfoot smells really do run the gamut. You have wet dog smells, fecal smells, decomposition smells, ammonia smells, basically smells of entropy when you really think about it. But a sizable chunk is this hydrogen sulfide rotten egg smell. And then some people, you know, just to say it smelled like sulfur, which I think most of us associate sulfur with that rotten egg odor.
Right, right. And with UFOs, you got a mix of stuff, but more, aside from the contactees, you get more negative smells than positive.
Yes, yeah. Some of the most common UFO smells are, again, sulfur smells like hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide, that fireworks or gunpowder smell is a little bit more common to UFO lore. But also ozone, there are some cases where it is very apparent either people specifically say ozone or they say something that is evocative of ozone, like a peppery smell or a piney smell. And then chemical smells like medicinal odors like camphor or disinfectant type odors, and burning odors also. It's another common theme that you see in a lot of this different literature.
Now with the UFO and Bigfoot smells, it sort of lends credence to the nuts and bolts, flesh and blood sort of thing to some degree.
Yes, I mean absolutely. I think that you know, my last book, A Trojan Feast, was, I think, very critical of the extraterrestrial hypothesis and not very critical of the biological Bigfoot hypothesis. This book is a reverse. So I actually entertain the ETH a little bit more in this book than I did in Trojan Feast. And I'm actually a little bit more in support of a supernatural Bigfoot angle in this book as well. But there are certain researchers who will tell you that hydrocarbons like benzene and whatnot are another common UFO smell. I don't think the literature quite bears that out, but it definitely seems to there definitely seems to be more mechanical odors that you run into with UFO encounters. What's interesting to me is that space actually has a smell, and moon dust actually has a smell as well. And they're often compared to sulfur. So that, again, that's another like little tick mark in favor of the ETH. Again, I'm not an ETH guy. I think anybody who listens to this podcast realizes that. But yeah, it does lend a little bit more credence to that philosophy.
And of course, with Bigfoot, you have a potential of a physical flesh and blood creature, or possibly something paranormal. You know what? We'll get into that in a little bit about the differences, but let's look at one of these sightings.
Right.
In 1908, you had the Alma, Colorado sighting, which was really fascinating in its perceptions.
Yeah, this is actually a perfect example of the sort of witness interpretation issue that I mentioned earlier. Around midnight one evening in 1908, people who were exiting the saloons in this small Colorado town saw this apparition in the street, and about half the witnesses described it as a beautiful woman clad in like a white nightgown, I believe. And wherever she disappeared, they actually said that they could smell perfume and roses and violets and really pleasant smells. And then half the other people who saw it said that it looked like some sort of huge elephant creature with fire coming out of its trunk and accompanied by the smell of sulfur and burning sulfur. So two descriptions that are probably about as disparate as they could possibly get.
Yeah.
Obviously the time frame would lend itself to the possibility of a newspaper hoax, but I think that conceptually that's selling this idea a little bit short, because, I think that's sort of an odd, that would be sort of an odd angle to take with a newspaper hoax. I don't know why you'd have half the people seeing something different or seeing and smelling something so different. So I wonder if perhaps there's not some sort of level of manipulation, at play there in a case like that.
Well, I also wonder, like, if people are seeing something their brains can't comprehend, and for some reason some people's brains jump to the elephant idea with the flames and everything else, and then their brain says, well, that would smell bad, and then they put that smell on it, whereas other people, you know, see this thing they can't understand and they postulate it's a woman. Their brain just goes, it's a ghost woman, and she smells nice, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a very astute point, and I think that really is sort of getting to the heart of a lot of these matters.
I mean, the elephant is just a ridiculous type of thing for anyone to see, but they saw it, and then, you know, is the smell there in the first place, or is there a smell, but that what they perceive as the smell is being guided by what their brain is putting on it, the face their brain is putting on it.
Right, and a lot of times we have difficulty really pinning down what smells are like. I mean, the olfactory researchers actually call this the tip of the nose phenomena. And sometimes we have a difficulty placing things. I mean, a fun bit of an experiment, if you want to do it with somebody, is to blindfold someone and hold a piece of Parmesan cheese under their nose. And do this to two different people. Tell one of them that you're making Italian and they'll be really happy. Tell another one that someone vomited and they're going to, you know, they're going to pull away in revulsion. So it's not as cut and dry. I mean, context does play a very strong role in how we interpret scents.
Get into a little bit of what Stan Gordon was researching in 1973. Now, you mentioned Stan Gordon a bunch of times in the book, but this 1973 bit was also interesting in the way that it kind of juxtaposed different things together.
Yeah, for somebody like me, I mean, I feel that these phenomena, I feel like it's becoming harder and harder to argue that all paranormal or a majority of paranormal phenomena are not connected in some manner. Now, I'm not saying that it's all the same thing, but I think at the very least there is a strong likelihood that similar techniques are used between these different phenomena. We can't partition these off like we used to, 20 or 30 years ago. So with that in mind, someone like Stan Gordon really is quite appealing to me. Because Stan Gordon's seminal book, Silent Invasion, actually detailed the flap in the 70s in Pennsylvania, where Sasquatch was seen in close proximity to UFO sightings. And this particular case was no exception. One evening in late October of 1973, a farmhouse in Pennsylvania was the site where a large, about 100-foot 100-foot red sphere dipped into a pasture. And some witnesses actually grabbed their rifles and went to investigate more closely and discovered that there were these two tall, like 8-foot tall, hairy ape men walking towards them. And they fired upon these ape men, which not only did the ape men seem unaffected by the bullets and ended up just walking into the tree line, but the giant sphere, the UFO, as it were, disappeared. Testimony from police officers later said that it was the that area where the UFO had landed actually ended up having a strong enough light to it that they could actually read the newspaper for hours afterwards. So the people in the farmhouse reached out to Stan Gordon's research group, and Gordon and his team arrived and began interviewing one of the witnesses. And after some time, they noticed the smell of rotten eggs in the room, and the witness begins to act agitated and actually attacks one of Gordon's team members, and raving like a lunatic, runs out the front door and into the landing site and passes out. And when they are actually able to wake him up, he says that he had seen visions of the apocalypse, and that he had seen some sort of spectral Grim Reaper type figure. So here you have something that not only includes the scent of sulfur, the scent of hydrogen sulfide, rotten eggs, but it also includes what we would traditionally consider UFO activity, what we would consider Bigfoot activity, and what we would consider what sounds a lot like a demonic possession. So it's sort of a tidy little bow for all three of these phenomena in one case.
And if you look at it, of course, there will be some people who are going to isolate out those different things. But it's also a possibility that some of this element of the paranormal is mimicking something that is simply unknown at this point that isn't necessarily paranormal. You saw ape-like creatures, but those may not have been flesh and blood Bigfoot encounters, and especially with the way that they were shot at and had no response. At the same time, there may also be flesh and blood Bigfoot out there, big feet.
Yeah, exactly.
That we just simply haven't been able to prove the existence of. And it seems like, you know, like if you talk to someone like Lyle Blackburn, he's going to tell you that he's never encountered any paranormal encounters in relation to Bigfoots. But obviously you have cases like this where that's a prime sort of thing there. What has you're studying the smell of them kind of said to you?
Well, you know, I think with somebody like Lyle, and I think the world of Lyle's work, but I feel like you look at the way that certain UFO alien abduction researchers tend to attract cases that reinforce their viewpoints. I think that maybe something similar happens with a lot of Bigfoot researchers, where they just tend to attract the more mundane Sasquatch sightings, if a Sasquatch sighting can be mundane. It appears to me, if we're like sort of making some large sweeping statements, that you will find the sulfurous odor attached to Bigfoot sightings when they are either seen in conjunction with a UFO or have some sort of high strangeness associated with them. And by that I mean they disappear, or they have glowing eyes that send out like little, you know, ray beams, you know, really strange stuff. And when you see the more animalistic Bigfoot smells, they usually tend to, like, you know, wet dog or ammonia or fecal smells or something. They tend to be associated with sightings that are more mundane, that don't necessarily have all this other high strangeness around it. So that not only suggests to me that perhaps smells can be used as some sort of way to differentiate between strange Bigfoot and you know, mundane Bigfoot, for lack of a better term. But it also sort of brings a really good question to my mind, which is, so Mike Cleland has written extensively on the prevalence of owls in UFO sightings, or rather that abductees will run into owls. Sometimes the owls that they see just appear in sort of synchronistic ways. Sometimes they appear to be, you know, directly used in a screen memory. Like, you know, I think there was an example that he likes to tell of a 3-foot-tall owl that's standing in the middle of the road looking over the bonnet of their car. But at the same time, Mike will not deny that there are flesh and blood owls that are absolutely mundane living creatures. So part of me wonders if perhaps we're not dealing with the reality of a flesh and blood ape-like Bigfoot whose imagery, whose depiction might sometimes be borrowed by a phenomena that's much stranger, in a way similar to what the way that the UFO phenomena seems to borrow from owl imagery. Because, I mean, so here's the frustrating thing about the Bigfoot thing is that you can't, if you're being intellectually honest, you cannot ignore either side of the argument, because there are plenty of cases where Bigfoot disappears, or people are following Sasquatch footprints in the snow into a field and they just stop, or where people see these glowing red eyes, really high strange stuff that shouldn't belong to any biological animal. And yet at the same time, on the other side, on the flip side of the argument, the pro-biological Bigfoot argument, you will find people describing primate behavior. People who don't really have any interest or knowledge of primate behavior will actually describe primate behavior, such as a pillow erection, the idea that hair stands up on its end. It's a common primatological thing and something that some people have reported in Bigfoot encounters. A lot of Native American pageantry on totem poles and such feature Sasquatch lips pursed in sort of a hooting configuration, which is obviously something very common to old world apes. So the only way that I can reconcile these two things is to propose that perhaps there are two things going on. One is a genuine cryptid, and the other one is something borrowing the countenance of that genuine cryptid for its own ends.
And you might see something like that too with the big spectral dog sightings, like some of these, or the big cat sightings, the alien cat sightings, where you might have some, you know, maybe someone had a tiger there or a lion that escaped from their personal zoo that no one knew about because, you know, they weren't supposed to have them. And other cases are actual paranormal appearances of these creatures.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as good of an explanation as anything. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you did do some work on the large dogs and the smells associated.
Yes. I've had a longstanding interest in the black dog phenomena, which is large dogs, sometimes the size of a small pony, that are traditionally seen at crossroads. You'll find them under a variety of names in England, as, you know, black shuck, or the bar guest, or, you know, different terms, but I'll describe this black dog, this devil hound, and surprise surprise, often people will encounter these black dogs and they'll smell like brimstone, they'll smell like sulfur. And there was one case of a person who actually reached out to pet one of these spectral black dogs in old England and ended up putting their hand through a cloud of mist that smelled like sulfur.
Now, I think the difference between like the Bigfoot and the dog encounters is this. We know dogs exist.
Right.
We know what dogs smell like. So if a dog smells like brimstone, we know that's weird. Whereas with a Bigfoot, if a Bigfoot exists as a flesh and blood creature that exists only here on Earth, that doesn't, you know, isn't interdimensional or something, we don't actually know what they would smell like normally. So they could maybe smell like brimstone, and we just don't know because we have some encounters where they do and some encounters where they don't.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It could also be that maybe all Bigfoots are somehow not from this world, but some of them are more anchored in this world, and those are the ones that smell more fleshy and have the more flesh and blood sort of encounters than the ones that haven't quite materialized here fully. Who knows?
I mean, yeah, I think that there's some validity to that. I mean, philosophically speaking, you know, there's been a longstanding tradition that the nose can sort of pierce the veil of reality. In other words, people don't believe their eyes, they believe their nose. You know, the nose knows. is a common saying, or we say that something doesn't pass the smell test or something doesn't smell right. I mean, these all are sort of driving to the fact that your nose is able to intuitively tell you the nature of a situation more than your other senses. So I think that sort of really dovetails nicely with what you said.
And also you have, you know, people will report rocks being thrown and things by Bigfoot, and use a term that I really like called wilderness poltergeists. And that is really what it behaves like. People assume that even if they don't see a Bigfoot, if it does certain things, that it must be a Bigfoot. But if the same thing happened in a house, it would be a poltergeist.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by what the BFRO deems Class B reports, which are reports where people find peripheral activity in the forest and attribute it to Bigfoot. So you'll have a case where someone is camping and they smell this awful smell like rotten meat, and they have these stones that are warm to the touch thrown at them, and they'll hear strange voices, and they'll say, oh, it must have been a Bigfoot. But all that could be used to describe poltergeist phenomena as well.
Yeah.
I know it's interesting to me. Some people claim that at habituation sites, Bigfoot will tap on walls and rap on walls, which, again, is another poltergeist thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, before anybody gets upset, like, I'm not suggesting that that is always the case. But it does make me wonder if perhaps, you know, unless you see a Bigfoot throwing a rock, you can't be guaranteed that that's what threw the rock. So sometimes I wonder if perhaps, just as human beings in certain circumstances can manifest a poltergeist flap, if perhaps a Sasquatch similarly couldn't be doing the same. So there might be a Sasquatch in the area, but they just so happen to be manifesting poltergeist phenomena as well.
it's almost frustrating how all this stuff can bleed across from one thing to another, because it makes you feel just kind of lost anytime you go, well, but there's this. Oh, wait, but then there's that.
Yeah, well, it's like, I guess Russian nesting doll isn't a very good analogy, but it's definitely one of those situations where it becomes paralyzing in a way, because there's so many different directions to take any one of these ideas.
Yeah, and they're contradictory to the other directions.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like you can work on both directions. It's like, okay, so you're researching Bigfoot as a flesh and blood creature, and as you said, if you're going to be intellectually honest, you can't throw out the paranormal aspects, which don't make any sense to a flesh and blood creature in many cases.
Exactly.
I mean, we're obviously missing something, is what it comes down to. but getting back to the dogs, Betty Hill was telling a story about someone she knew chasing a large dog. Was that it?
Yeah, so there was a group of people who actually ended up writing a letter to Betty Hill. They were looking for – there was basically UFO – they were sky watching for UFOs in Elliott, Maine in 1966. And they pulled into this gravel pit when they noticed this – unnaturally large dog that ran past the car. So everyone except for one individual, they all hopped out of the car, but everyone except for one individual chased after this dog. The last person in line was stopped in his tracks by this strange odor. And after a moment, he saw what looked like some sort of ominous robed figure in this gravel pit who he assumed was producing the smell. And he was compelled to follow it as it glided away. And apparently, according to this particular account, he had to fight with all of his might to exert the willpower to not follow this figure. So a really odd story that, again, is one of those stories where different phenomena blend. But I find it interesting because, is it possible that the smell had some sort of effect on him? You know, was able to override his free will somehow? I think that's very strongly implied by a story like that.
And I hadn't heard this story before, but what it makes me think of is in a lot of the wilderness disappearances, it's usually the first person in a line of people that's like way ahead, or the last person that's kind of lingering behind, that ends up disappearing. In numerous cases that David Politis has put out there, it has always seemed to me like when the last time you see the person before, you know, the rest of the people walk around, they're kind of like focused on something, you know, looking off to the side. And I'm thinking, you know, you tell this story and I'm thinking, are they smelling something? Is that what's drawing their attention initially? Is this, and you know, would that person have been a missing 411 person at some point where they came back and they were just gone if they hadn't broke the spell and followed them?
That's an excellent point, one that I hadn't really considered, but there is sort of a, it is very evocative of the missing 411 stuff in terms of the way that people were, you know, the stragglers are always the ones that are picked off.
Yeah, and I mean, because it seems to me there needs to be something to distract them. It always seems like they're distracted by something. They're looking at something, and a smell would certainly draw them right to something.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's one thing to see a flick of light in the distance or something and go like, well, what was that? But if you smell something strong, you're going to stop. You're going to be like, whoa.
Yeah, it's going to stop you. It's going to stop you in your tracks. I mean, I have plenty of cases that I ran into where people, like, basically it was almost as if they were running into a wall of stench, you know, in the woods. And that's been right before they saw a Sasquatch staring at them.
Yeah. You also cover, as we talked about already, you cover some of the weird stuff that has odors to it, like star jelly, which I had something like this land on my car once, and I had no idea what it was. I didn't smell it, so I don't know what it smelled like, but this was kind of a jelly formation that fell on my windshield during, I believe it was like an on and off sort of rainy type of period. And the windshield wipers didn't want to move it at all. It just left stains. And eventually, I think the rain, you know, wore it away and it went away. But you tell people a little bit about this.
Yeah, it's one of the things that people, I don't think, really talk about that much. But it's pidreth ser was the term in Welsh, which means star rot. And it's this idea that this jelly falls to earth from time to time, very much tied into concepts of Fortean falls from the sky, like rains of blood or rains of frogs or, you know, nails or whatever. This is a relatively common phenomena throughout time, where these giant globs of stinky, smelly, gelatinous material will fall to earth. In modern years, people have suggested that perhaps this is frozen and thawed airline toilet waste, which I kind of have a hard time buying, or vulture vomit, which I have a hard time buying too. But there have been some cases, especially in the 19th century, where individuals, scientists, have a claim to have actually harvested some of this star jelly. And in almost every case, it was, you know, this overpowering, suffocating smell that induces nausea and vomiting in people, and just this awful, awful odor. In more modern years, it was about a little bit over 30 years ago, two ladies were driving in Michigan, and around 3 a.m. their car stalled, and they noticed that this brown slime was falling from the sky, and they said that it had this smell that was very similar to rotten eggs. Again, we see this hydrogen sulfide description rearing its head again.
And it may be something totally natural that causes it. I mean, when it happened to me, I thought it was weird, but I wasn't thinking supernatural. It was just kind of like, what the hell just fell on my car?
Oh, to the contrary. Like, to agree with you, I suspect that this is probably some sort of phenomena that sort of falls into the realm of the preternatural. In other words, it's something that is entirely explainable by natural mechanisms,
science.
But we just haven't gotten around to studying it in depth yet.
Because it doesn't happen enough, I think, is part of the problem there.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
You also deal with chupacabras and their smell.
El chupacabras, yeah. So in case anyone doesn't know, chupacabras are a phenomena that El chupacabras are a phenomena that really reared its head for the first time in the mid-90s in Puerto Rico. Farmers said that their livestock were being exsanguinated by this short little entity with a large head and large almond-shaped dark eyes and a row of spines down its back, and it would hop around and it was sucking the blood from all their livestock. In some cases, people said that the kill sites of El Chupacabras left behind a smell like, guess what, brimstone. Again, granted, there are other people who claimed to have encountered chupacabras that smelled like battery acid or paint thinner, but sulfur was a very common scent that clung not only to the entities themselves, but also their kill sites. There was one woman who claimed that she could always tell if a chupacabra was around because she could smell it, and then she knew that, you know, that was the sign. I'm a little bit dubious as to a livestock kill that smells like hydrogen sulfide not having something more to do with decomposition. I mean, when anything dies, it releases a couple of different compounds. Cadaverine and putrescine are two compounds that have that rotten corpse odor, but also a variety of sulfur compounds as well. I mean, you've got hydrogen sulfide, as we mentioned earlier, but also, you know, methanethiol, dimethyl disulfide, dimethyl trisulfide. I mean, a lot of different sulfur components you'll find in these decomposition smells. So maybe that has something to do with the entity. Maybe it doesn't. I do think it's interesting, though, you know, returning to this idea of decomposition. We are so sensitive to the smell of sulfur in general. I mean, if you were to take an ink dropper and to drop it into a semi-truck trailer full of water, that would be twice the concentration at which we can detect hydrogen sulfide. We can detect hydrogen sulfide at 0.47 parts per billion. So we're extremely sensitive to this odor. And even when we don't realize it, a lot of things that we think smell badly because of an underlying sulfur component. I mean, you know, there was a case in a 1979 UFO sighting from Massachusetts where the witness said the UFO smelled like skunk spray. Well, one of the main malodorants in skunk spray are thiols. They're sulfur compounds. You know, another witness said that the UFO smelled like household gas. Well, household gas doesn't have an odor. People add mercaptans to household gas to provide an olfactory warning as to gas leaks. Mercaptans are sulfurous. So you find a lot of these encounters where people don't even think about something having to do with sulfur. They're actually describing something that whose main component of being smelly is sulfur.
And you didn't tackle cattle mutilations.
Yeah, you know, cattle mutilations are, I feel like, so I had to draw the line somewhere, right? And cattle mutilations to me just seemed like they would be a little bit too much of a rabbit hole for me to fall down. Plus, I mean, I think when you, as I mentioned with the livestock mutilations involving the chupacabras, you'll find that, I mean, I feel like it would be too easy to start mixing up the smell of the decaying corpse versus the smell of an entity that might have left something behind. So I did draw a line there at that. But having said that, you know, there are plenty of cases that I've encountered, or at least a handful of cases that I've encountered, where some sort of medicinal or chemical smell was left behind at a cattle mutilation site. Again, it's something I just didn't go into because I feel like there's some really good literature out there that probably does a better job of covering that sort of angle of the topic than I ever could. But yeah, I didn't go into the cattle mutilation thing in this one, not this time around.
Well, Christopher O'Brien seems to have written the penultimate book on cattle mutilations. It'd be hard for too much to be added to it, short of a breakthrough at this point.
Exactly. Yeah. Stalking the Herd. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I didn't do it is because I'm like, I don't know what I would say that Chris hasn't already. So,
let's talk a little bit about the Dog Man.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. In case Dogman's all the rage nowadays, but in case someone doesn't know what it is, sightings often in the upper Midwest, but a little bit of everywhere nowadays, it seems like, this bipedal creature, you know, muscular, with a dog's head. Basically, imagine Sasquatch with a dog's head, and claws. There are a couple of encounters where where Dogman has been sighted, and he's had an awful, awful smell. For example, there was a 1936 case from Racine, Wisconsin, where a man saw this Dogman creature skulking about some Native American burial grounds. And he said that it ended up smelling like long dead meat. So again, these concepts of foul smells of decomposition and decay and rot. I mean, really, you look at a lot of these smells, and they're all smells of entropy. You know, you have burning smells, you have decaying smells, you have rotten smells. Like these are all smells that sort of are you would expect to run into with the breakdown of matter into its constituent elements.
Well, maybe these things are projecting into our reality in a way that they immediately start breaking down. And that's where the smell comes from.
That's an interesting angle that I hadn't ever really considered, but I should have conferred with you on this, right?
Because, I mean, we don't know, you know, if they're here long term. I mean, these things just seem to vanish. So maybe part of the reason they vanish is they're projecting into our reality from wherever. Whether it be another dimension or even another planet or another frequency of matter, and they just can't sustain it, so they immediately start decaying.
I mean, yeah, that's a great point. I mean, and it sort of dovetails with, in an oblique way, some of John Keel's ideas. Keel felt that perhaps the act of entering into our realm. Might somehow generate smells of hydrogen sulfide, which isn't quite exactly what you're talking about, but it, you know, is a little bit of it.
Yeah,
So that's not a bad suggestion at all.
And speaking of Keel, let's talk a little bit about the Men in Black and their smells, as well as Black Eyed Kids.
Yeah. So you'll find. It's almost becoming a trope now at this point. Yes, Men in Black smell like sulfur too. Black Eyed Kids smell like sulfur too. There is no shortage of cases where people will notice a foul, like burning smell from Men in Black that will actually give witnesses a headache. Sometimes they smell like formaldehyde. You'll find cases of varying description like that in the literature. It's interesting because one of the very first Men in Black cases, the first appearances of the Men in Black was by Albert Bender, who was founder of the International Flying Saucer Bureau. And I believe Bender was living with his mom and dad, and he was keeping his IFSB files in their attic. And he had returned home from the cinema, an experience where I believe he felt like he was being followed all the way back home. And he gets to the top of the stairs, and there's a light coming in from the attic, from underneath the attic door. And he opens it up, and he goes inside, and his files are disturbed, and he notices, like, this bright light that sort of just fades away, and he's hit with this smell of burning sulfur. And this sort of kicked off the first set of regular visits that he would have with the MIB. Three Men in Black, who he said always were accompanied by a strong odor of sulfur or decomposing eggs. The Men in Black smells are a common thing too. Again, that sulfur smell. Thinking to Black Eyed Kids, which have a lot in common with Men in Black, actually,
yeah.
You know, appearing on your doorstep and asking you to come in, being awkward socially. People will claim that they smell not only like the grave, so earth, decay, but you also find people claiming that the black-eyed kids smell, again, like sulfur. Not in a ton of cases. I believe that David Weatherly said it was like maybe somewhere around 25 or 30% of the cases that he had encountered. But that's still a significant enough number, I would think.
Yeah. All right, let's jump into a little bit of your speculation at the end. The first thing is the idea of suspended animation that can be caused by different chemicals.
Right. So in trying to... the cases where smell is noticed in paranormal encounters fall into one of two categories. Either, you know, sulfur smells, almost exclusively hydrogen sulfide. Because I think a lot of times when people say sulfur, they probably mean hydrogen sulfide, that rotten egg smell.
Right.
So sulfur smells and not sulfur smells. But what do we make of the prevalence of sulfur smells, this plurality of cases that involve sulfur smells? Well, about a little bit over a decade ago, researchers from the University of Washington declared that they had created a state of suspended animation in mice utilizing nothing other than hydrogen sulfide. Now, I mentioned earlier how sensitive we are to hydrogen sulfide. The reason we're so sensitive is because it's actually quite dangerous. It was used as a chemical warfare agent in World War I. So hydrogen sulfide can kill you, can be nasty stuff. But in this particular case, they were able to specifically monitor amounts of hydrogen sulfide administered to these mice. And when they did this, they were actually able to basically lower the metabolism of these mice a ridiculous amount. I mean, so they were put into this state for 6 hours, and the mice took 10 breaths per minute. Their baseline had been 120. Breaths per minute, and their body temperature plummeted to 51.8 degrees Fahrenheit, which is shocking. I mean, essentially, these things were made to be cold-blooded. They were, as of, you know, 11 years ago, they were pushing ahead with human trials. Not a lot has been made on that front in terms of headway that I've heard, but it's really fascinating that the most common paranormal smell has the possibility to put mammals into an altered state. Now, I'm not saying that hydrogen sulfide is hallucinogenic, but what I am saying is that it doesn't take much imagination to perceive a state of light suspended animation or even a fully immersed suspended animation state having a similar experience as hypnagogic states or hypnopompic states. It seems to me like there's the potential for a suspended animation scenario to sort of set the stage for another intelligence to interact with people, basically slipping them into this sort of light suspended animation so that they're in basically an altered state of sorts.
Your theory around that, like they could be, you point out that you get the sort of suspended state sort of smells at the beginning of some encounters, and near the end you get the type of smells that are, is it trigeminal stimulation?
Yeah, so this isn't a great, this is sort of a half-formed hypothesis at this point, right? Because we only have like the one set of smells. So how do we explain the rest of the smells? Is there any sort of commonality to the outliers? And I was able to discover that there sort of is a shared commonality. So one of the largest nerves in our faces is the trigeminal nerve. It's what is responsible for giving us sensations of hot, spicy foods or cool, like minty foods. And anyone who wants to sort of see what their trigeminal nerve feels like should just open up a bottle of vinegar and take a big old whiff through your nose. And that sort of stinging, pungent sensation, because that's the actual definition of pungent, is that that irritating sensation. That's your trigeminal nerve being stimulated. And if you look at the list of smells, of odors that are strong trigeminal stimulants, it reads like a laundry list of the smells from the book. So camphor, ammonia, benzenes, certain aldehydes, cinnamon, which we didn't really talk about, but ozone, like a lot of these different things are trigeminal stimulants. I mean, if you look at the odor of onions, that's a trigeminal stimulant too, because you get watery eyes. So what's interesting about this is that trigeminal stimulants, or trigeminal stimulation rather, is the mechanism by which smelling salts work to rouse people from unconsciousness. And that's when sort of this hypothesis comes together a little bit, is that you have two categories of smells, right? The hydrogen sulfide smells and the trigeminal stimulants. Also, sulfur dioxide, which is that gunpowder smell, is a trigeminal stimulant as well. So you have hydrogen sulfide smells and other smells. Of these two categories, hydrogen sulfide can put people into an unconscious state, or rather a state of diminished consciousness. And the other smells, the trigeminal stimulants, have the ability to rouse people from unconsciousness. So they're set at two ends of a spectrum. So the hypothesis becomes that perhaps by means unknown, an intelligence can implement and slip an individual into a light trance of sorts with hydrogen sulfide, interact with the witness, and then in order to either accelerate their recovery or to fully initiate the recovery, administer a trigeminal stimulant, perhaps one that has some sort of intimate connection for the witness, some sort of scent that might call back a memory or invoke some sort of reaction. Depending on where someone is paying attention, they might notice the hydrogen sulfide smell, or if they're paying more attention after the fact, they might actually notice the trigeminal stimulant, as you know, after the fact, and when they recall their sighting.
And one of the things you talk about, which I don't think I fully realized, is that we all know about missing time and UFO encounters, but people who have Bigfoot and other encounters also experience some time dilation as well. You were saying.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a podcast that I actually do enjoy, but it's a very popular Sasquatch podcast, and the podcast has historically a strong reputation as dismissing people who would dare suggest that Sasquatch is anything but a flesh and blood creature. I found this incredibly ironic because the podcast, which was started by someone who had actually had their own sighting, said that, when I was up there in the car watching these things that were surrounding our car, it felt like it was about 40 minutes max, but I got back and I checked the clock and it had been 4 hours. And I'm just like, are you kidding me? That is straight up a missing time event. Yeah. And it's Sasquatch sighting. To a lesser degree, you'll have people say that time slows down when they're staring at a Sasquatch. But this is, missing time is definitely a common theme in alien abduction cases. It's also something that you sort of is alluded to in sleep paralysis cases where people feel like time slows down and it feels like forever. So I can't help but...
It suggests an altered state as well.
It does. And I can't help but think that... I can't help but suspect that if you were in a state of suspended animation, your interpretation of time would change. And coincidentally enough, this suspended animation concept, would also handily explain why so many different paranormal witnesses claim that they're paralyzed during the encounter.
It's a great theory. I mean, it doesn't explain everything by any means, but it seems like it could be a small piece of a bigger puzzle.
Yeah, it's not perfect because there are plenty of cases where people don't notice a smell at all in any of these cases.
It could just be how these things approach people in different ways. There could be multitudes of different ways that people interact with this phenomena.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think maybe some of it's like the hypothesis from a Trojan Feast, and maybe some of it's like the hypothesis from the Brimstone Deceit.
And you have a chapter at the end on alchemy, which is pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, I feel like you have to address alchemy when talking about this, but it was one of those things where I'm like, come on, guys, just give me like 3 pages to get you up to speed, crash course in alchemy. Because it's not something that you can just jump right into. But yeah, the reason that you have to talk about it is because in alchemical philosophy, it was the primary constituents of all matter were salt, mercury, and sulfur. Originally taken literally and then, reinterpreted as sort of a philosophical version of those particular elements. But it's interesting, like, you know, Mercury represented the more stereotypically feminine, subdued, creative, submissive aspect of creation, and Sulfur was the fiery, passionate, masculine, dominating sort of aspect of reality.
All right. Well, you know what? I mean, people might think I'm biased because you are essentially a co-host on this show, but this book is excellent, and I do not say that because you know you're on this show. It was an exceptional read. You pull up so much stuff that I don't think anyone has ever touched on before. And for anyone who missed it, the book is called The Brimstone Deceit, an in-depth examination of supernatural scents, otherworldly odors, and monstrous miasmas.
I really appreciate the kind words, Soraya. You know,
they're honest words.
Well, I appreciate it. It's sort of the niche that I hoped to carve out for myself after A Trojan Feast, is looking at things that might have been the focus of a chapter here and there throughout the literature, but things that had never really gotten the true full-length, book-length treatment that they deserve. So the food taboo thing was one of them, and the smell aspect is something that, you know, here's a new thing, because I think that people have spent so much time trying to solve the big mysteries. What are UFOs? Is Sasquatch real? You know, do the spirits of the dead return to Earth? That they forget to, they forget the possibility that some sort of tiny detail that we might perceive as insignificant might actually, upon further examination, give us some deeper insight into the phenomena.
Yeah, and I think you do. I really do. It's not going to explain it all, but it's giving us some more insight that no one has picked up before. The book is on Anomalous Books, which is a great book company, by the way. They publish many good things, including both of your books, and it's available pretty much everywhere, right?
Yes, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The formats as of right now are paperback, Kindle, ebook, and something called a Kobo. I think there's another e-reader format as well, but pretty much pick your poison.
Nice. All right, and we're gonna take you out with something from your band, the Half Dozen Brass Band.
Yes. Yeah,
off the CD Cold Six, which came out in 2012. This is still an active project.
It's sort of on hiatus right now.
Okay,
but yeah, this was the latest album of the band. I think we talked about doing Loa Dance, is that right?
Yeah, Loa yeah. Dance, and this is available on Amazon, correct?
Yes, and Loa Dance is a song, it's an original composition that I wrote. The Loa were the spirits of voodoo practitioners who would actually enter the bodies of those performing a ritualized dance and sort of inhabit their bodies, wear them as like a flesh suit. And this sort of song was an attempt to sort of... capture a little bit of that. So I hope everybody enjoys it.
All right. And people can find you online where?
Here at Where Did the Road Go?
Of course.
But also joshuacutchin.com. I have a blog there, and I keep track of all my radio interview appearances.
All right. Thanks so much, Josh.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure as always, Soraya.